From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the secret writings and religious texts that were suppressed by the early Christian church. We talk with religion scholar Elaine Pagels about the secret Gospel of Thomas. It's believed to contain some of the private teachings of Jesus, and it's the subject of her new book, Beyond Belief. Also, Bart Ehrman tells us about the different interpretations of Christ found in three early religious sects. His books are Lost Scriptures and Lost Christianities. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, starring Will Ferrell. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate Intelligence Committee released a 510-page report today that says American intelligence services were almost entirely wrong in their assessments of Iraq's weapons capacity. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The report has about a fifth of its text blacked out at the insistence of the Central Intelligence Agency. Republican Pat Roberts chairs the Intelligence Committee.
In the end, what the President and the Congress used to send the country to war was information that was provided by the intelligence community, and that information was flawed.
Jay Rockefeller, the panel's top Democrat, predicted damage caused by bad intelligence will last a generation.
There is simply no question that mistakes leading up to the war in Iraq rank among the most devastating losses and intelligence failures in the history of the nation.
Democrats fault the report for not looking at how the Bush administration used intelligence in making its case for war. That's to be examined in a later report. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Doctors at a U.S. military hospital in Germany say Marine Corporal Wasef Ali Hassoun is exhausted but in excellent condition after turning up safe in Lebanon this week. Hassoun was reported missing from his unit in Iraq nearly 3 weeks ago. He was later seen on Arabic television, apparently a captive of kidnappers. Hassoun was falsely reported to have been beheaded, but was later said to have been released by his abductors. Military investigators looking into his story say they're considering the possibility that it could have been a hoax. Doctors at Landstuhl Medical Center say Hassoun lost about 20 pounds during his absence, but showed no signs of abuse. They say he has not yet spoken about what happened to him. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is hailing today's world court ruling as a victory for the Palestinian people. And the court said Israel's West Bank barrier violates international law. Israel says it won't abide by the ruling. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Jerusalem.
The court found that the Israeli barrier in the occupied Palestinian territories contravenes international law, despite Israel's right to defend itself against deadly Palestinian attacks. The court recommended that the illegal sections be dismantled. Palestinians called the ruling a major breakthrough and urged the United Nations Security Council to pass a binding resolution on the subject. But the Bush administration, which holds a veto on the Security Council, quickly sided with Israel in dismissing the decision, saying the World Court was not the appropriate forum for such a decision and affirming Israel's right to defend its citizens. Israel will abide by the rulings of its own High Court, which recently ordered a part of the barrier moved to ease Palestinian suffering. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow gained 41 points today to close at 10,213. This is NPR News. Senate Republicans have begun debate on a constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriage. The amendment would add language to the Constitution defining marriage as a union between one man and one woman. Democrats accused Republicans of raising the issue to garner the votes of social conservatives in the November elections. The vote on the issue is set for next Wednesday, but even supporters have little hope that it will pass. A federal appeals court has rejected Nevada's bid to kill the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste storage project. But state officials say another part of the ruling will make it very difficult for the project to go forward. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
The second part of the ruling says the federal government must come up with a new plan to protect the public against radiation beyond the 10,000 years currently proposed. Nevada's nuclear project director says that effectively kills the Yucca Mountain Storage Project. But the U.S. Energy Department says it only needs to convince Congress or the Environmental Protection Agency to change the standard.
That's sort of their spin about everything. They've never seen a problem at Yucca Mountain at all, ever.
Bob Lux heads Nevada's Agency for Nuclear Projects and says the federal government may find it more difficult to change that standard than it predicts. More than $8 billion has already been spent to prepare Yucca Mountain to receive nuclear waste currently being stored at sites across the country. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 11 points to close at 1946. The NASDAQ lost 60 points for the week. The S&P 500 was up 3 points to 1112. It was down 12 points for the week. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MGM Pictures, presenting Kevin Kline and Ashley Judd in Da Lovely, the story of music legend Cole Porter, in theaters July 2nd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Elaine Pagels, is one of the leading scholars of early Christianity. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University. Her book, The Gnostic Gospels, which won a National Book Award and a National Book Critics Award, focused on the secret writings from the early centuries of Christianity. They contained sayings, rituals, and dialogues attributed to Jesus and his disciples. These writings were suppressed by the church and kept out of the canon. In 1945, they were discovered buried in Egypt along with other texts from the early Christian era. Terry spoke to Elaine Pagels last year. Her book Beyond Belief on one of the early texts, the Gospel of Thomas, has just been released in paperback. Thomas is the apostle who was described as Doubting Thomas in the Gospel of John. Pagels thinks that the Gospel of Thomas actually preceded John's. She believes the Gospel of John was written in opposition to Thomas and that the followers of Thomas and John were rivals.
John is a kind of polemical picture of Thomas in which he appears as somebody who has no faith, who doubts everything, who understands nothing, and who basically has no authority as an apostle. The Gospels of Luke and Matthew also mention Thomas, but there he's just one of the disciples. So when you see that in the Gospel of John, he's not only mentioned, he becomes a full-fledged character and he becomes a totally negative character, you begin to realize that whoever wrote the Gospel of John was writing a polemic against that teacher and his teachings.
Let's talk about some of the things that are revelatory about the Gospel of Thomas. He describes every person as having some light of God within them, that God isn't just within Jesus, it's within everyone. How does he express that?
What's remarkable about the Gospel of Thomas is that when it asks the question, who is Jesus, it suggests, as also does the Gospel of John, that he's a manifestation of the divine light that came into being in the beginning of time. And the good news, or the gospel, is that so are you, right? That everyone comes from that same divine light. According to the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus teaches his disciples and says, if they say to you, who are you? Say, we come from the light, the place where the light came into being. And if they say, who is your father? Say, we are children of the light, children of the living Father. So this is a teaching, a gospel, about all beings, all humans coming from that divine light.
And let me quote something else from the Gospel of Thomas that you quote in your book. The kingdom is inside you and outside you. When you come to know yourselves, then you will be known, and you will see that it is you who are the children of the living Father. But if you will not know yourselves, you dwell in poverty, and it is you who are that poverty. What does that mean to you?
This gospel interprets the kingdom of God, which is the topic of Jesus' preaching according to Matthew and Luke, and interprets that as a way of coming to know God and to know yourself in relation to God, know yourself as coming from that divine source. It also suggests, however, that the divine energy, which is the source of all life, isn't just in human beings, but is actually in the whole universe. It's not just inside of you, but it's outside of you.
Is that kind of similar to Jewish mysticism, to Hebrew mysticism?
it's strikingly similar to Jewish mysticism. In fact, you know, so much of what we think of as Kabbalistic tradition, which comes into literature about 1,000 years after this, is based on an image of all being coming from the divine source, which is usually depicted in Jewish mysticism, as you rightly say, as light, as the divine light, and as the being which brings everything into being. And so this text looks, interestingly, like a kind of very early form of Jewish mysticism. But it's hard to track that because we have almost nothing written like it that early.
Now, you also say that the Gospel of Thomas rebukes those who try to find God by just trying to follow Jesus. What does he say about that?
Well, this text claims to be the secret teaching of Jesus, not the public teaching. The public teaching of Matthew and Mark and Luke is about following the injunctions of Jesus, you know, believing in Jesus and so forth. And this text claims to be for people who have gone to a different level. And so the Gospel of Thomas never speaks about believing in Jesus except in one place where the disciples don't understand. And they say to Jesus, "Tell us who you are so that we may believe in you." It's as though they're sort of desperate to say, "Tell us something and we'll believe it." But here the emphasis is not on belief at all. It's as though after you first come to this movement with belief, you have to let go of that and find some kind of deeper understanding.
And that deeper understanding gets back to the sense of that light being within everybody and everything.
Yes, so that in this text, there's a kind of irony very often when the disciples keep asking Jesus questions, and he keeps throwing the questions back to them. For example, there's a saying in which the disciples say, "Well, tell us what to do. You know, what diet shall we observe? Shall we give to charity? How shall we pray?" Now, if you read Matthew and Luke, Jesus tells them, he says, "When you pray, say, 'Our Father in heaven.'" I mean, he gives them an actual prayer, you know, the one called the Lord's Prayer. And he says, "When you fast, do this. When you give alms, do it this way." In this text, he simply turns to them the question and says, "Do not tell lies and do not do what you hate, for everything is known before your Father in heaven." So you think, well, who knows when you're lying? Who knows what you hate? You're the only person, you're the expert. So you have to ask yourself that question. And then the questions about what do you do flow from what you understand about yourself.
Now, you've come to think that the Gospel of John was written in response to the Gospel of Thomas. What are some of the points that John makes in his Gospel that contradict what Thomas says?
What's fascinating is that the Gospel of John in the New Testament and the Gospel of Thomas have so much in common. They both talk about Jesus as the divine light, you know, the one who reveals the divine light that was in the beginning. But it's very interesting when you start to compare them in detail, because the Gospel of Thomas will have Jesus say, "You too are from the light. You too come from that source in God originally." The Gospel of John, by contrast, has Jesus say, "I come from above, you come from below. I am not of this world, you are from this world." You know, and he goes on to say in chapter 8, "I am the light of the world. If you whoever follows me will not die in sins. But if you do not follow me, you will die in your sins." And that whole idea in the Gospel of John, so familiar to Christians, that, you know, you're going to die in sin if you don't believe in Jesus, is completely absent from this text.
Is it fair to say that the Gospel of John is now considered the most important of the Gospels?
That's a really interesting question, Terry, because I don't know if most people would say it's the most important, but it certainly, I think, has become the lens through which people read them all. For example, Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't suggest that Jesus was actually a divine person, although we usually read them as if they did say that. I think the reason people usually read them as if they said that is that they read them through the lens of the Gospel of John, which basically says that Jesus is God in person. And that's very radical. That's one thing I learned in this study, is that that message about Jesus being God in person is quite particular to the Gospel of John. And it's written as a sort of counter to the teaching of Thomas that, in fact, well, yes, Jesus is the Son of God, but you too are also the child of God when you come to recognize who you really are.
Okay, well, it's very interesting, you know, that the Gospel of John, which says that, Jesus, you know, was God, that Christ died for our sins, that those who don't believe in Jesus will be condemned to eternal death.
Yes.
That is the gospel that has lived, whereas the Gospel of Thomas, the more mystical gospel in which that sense of God, that illumination is in everybody and everything, that gospel was censored. It was ordered to be destroyed. What was so offensive to the powers of the time? I mean, what was offensive and who was it offensive to?
It's hard to know, you know, who might have actually censored this text because it happened very early and before we have any records of that. But it seems that this teaching that sort of everyone can find the light within is not a very good basis for founding a kind of a church which rests on the premise that, you know, you must believe in Jesus, you must follow the church, this is the only true way. The teaching about, you know, light found in everyone, for example, is something you find in the Society of Friends founded by George Fox, the founder of the Quakers. And it's not very good for institution building. And that may have a great deal to do with why that kind of egalitarian message, if you like, is not included in the New Testament as we know it, because that collection was born out of struggle and persecution and strife as this movement was trying to survive in a very dangerous world.
Princeton religion professor Elaine Pagels, author of the book Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Elaine Pagels, author of the book Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas.
Now, you credit Irenaeus, am I saying his name right?
Yes, Irenaeus.
Who was the bishop of Lyon at the end of the second century, with promoting John as the true gospel and excluding Thomas and other early gospels. Who was he and how did he get this power to decide what the true gospels were?
Well, it's fascinating. He really had very little power. He was the leader of a persecuted Christian group in what is now France. And he was simply trying to consolidate the group of Christians that he knew. But what he did was, he was the first one, as far as we know, to say that John had to be connected with the other Gospels. It had to be the way we read them all, you know. And then he goes on to say, and not only do you have to read the Gospel of John, you have to read it my way. And his way meant that Jesus is actually God. And that, you know, later, in a completely unexpected turn of events, when the Roman Empire itself became Christian, the emperor was converted to this new movement, that became the group of gospels that Emperor Constantine called the legitimate and holy and Catholic Church. It was that group of churches that were very well organized, that were founded on certain beliefs and certain kinds of structure, that became Orthodox Christianity as we know it. Irenaeus in his own time wasn't powerful, but his idea, so to speak, was the wave of the future, which was used when this movement became not only legitimate, but actually dominant in the Roman Empire.
You say it was Athanasius, am I saying his name right?
Yes.
In the year 367, who was the Bishop of Alexandria, who ordered all the secret gospels to be burned. And he named the books that are now in the New Testament as being the only correct gospels. Who was he in, and what gave him that power?
What's quite remarkable is that, you know, we think of the New Testament collection as coming out of the beginning of the movement, but actually it's nearly four centuries before we find a collection which is declared canonical. That only happened when you had powerful bishops. In fact, bishops backed by military and police power when you finally had a Christian empire. And Athanasius did that as he was trying to consolidate all the Christian groups over Egypt. There were very diverse groups and diverse authorities and diverse teachers, and he wanted to make sure they were all consolidated under his leadership as the single bishop who was most powerful in Egypt. And this collection, he thought, would work for that purpose. So he basically said, these are the springs of salvation. These 27 books are the right ones. All those other books, get rid of them. They're secret. They're apocryphal. They teach terrible blasphemy.
Are you suggesting that perhaps one of the reasons why leaders of the church chose the Gospel of John over the Gospel of Thomas is that the Gospel of John taught to be followers of the leader Jesus? And if you're a leader of the church, if other people are followers, it gives you more power. Are you suggesting that?
I think that's certainly part of it. It also, the Gospel of John has a very simple message, as you just quoted it. I mean, think how many Christians you see on billboards. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Whoever believes on him has everlasting life, and whoever doesn't believe in him is condemned forever. So it's a very clear message. You know, this is the way to be saved. We have it. You can join it, but you must join this church, and in doing so, you become one of God's children. Anybody outside is eternally damned. That's a very clear, concise message, and it has proven powerful from the beginning to now.
I'm sure that some people listening now consider what you're saying to be a bit sacrilegious, because you're challenging some of the basic assumptions of a lot of people within the Christian church, and you're saying that these challenges are based on history, they're based on scholarship, but that's going to sound sacrilegious. Mm-hmm.
It is startling. I mean, for many people, particularly in this country, thinking about religion is kind of counterintuitive. It's almost something you're not supposed to do. So, yes, saying that the creed that most Christians accept, many Christians accept, the Nicene Creed or the New Testament list of books, was actually constructed at some time, was built up, was decided upon, was, you know, there were books left in and books left out, and there were huge arguments about what should be believed and what shouldn't be believed. When you look at the history of it, it doesn't look at all like some obvious grand scheme. You know, it looks like a struggling process of building a movement and an institution. So I guess anyone who begins to look beyond the surface of it will find that troubling. If you look at it as a historian at all, that's what you see.
You know, you were talking about beliefs, and if somebody says to you, are you a Christian, and you say, what does that mean? They'll ask you if you believe certain things, and one of the things they might ask you if you believe is, do you believe in the virgin birth? Where does that originate?
It's a fascinating question about the virgin birth. If you look at the earliest account of Jesus, that's the Gospel of Mark, this Gospel says nothing about the birth of Jesus. It begins with his baptism. In chapter 6, however, Jesus is called the son of Mary, the son of Miriam. And what that suggests in a culture in which children are named for their fathers is that he may not have had a father for whom to be named. We know that he was accused of being illegitimate by his opponents, and his followers defended his legitimacy, of course, not only that, but his royal lineage. The Gospel of Matthew traces him to the house of David and all the way back to King David. And the Gospel of Luke actually traces him back to Adam, which is quite remarkable. But both of them seem to have a concern about the irregularity of the birth of Jesus. So we really don't know much about the birth of Jesus. What we know historically, as my colleague Raymond Brown, who was a Roman Catholic scholar who studied this, is that he was probably born too early to be legitimate. And his detractors said that he was illegitimate, and his admirers said that it was a miracle. What I think Matthew and Luke did was go back to the book of Isaiah, which they believed had prophesied many things about the coming of Jesus. And when they came to the verse in chapter 7 that said, behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. They were reading not in Hebrew, which would have said what I just said, but they were reading apparently in Greek. And the Greek reads, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son." And I would imagine that if Matthew and Luke were distressed by allegations that Jesus was illegitimate, and with their own convictions that he was, after all, the divinely appointed Son of God, they would have said, "Aha, this explains it. There was a prophecy that a virgin would conceive and bear a son, and that must have been what happened." And so each of them constructed an account of how that might have happened.
What would be your interpretation of that Greek text with the word virgin?
Well, the Greek text is a translation of the Hebrew, in which the word, the Hebrew alma, young woman, is translated parthenos, which is an all right translation, but it means sort of unmarried woman, you know, presumed to be virgin. And so it's that discrepancy in the text that I think opens up the possibility that Mary conceived in some miraculous way.
What a huge discrepancy that ends up being.
Well, it's remarkable, and it was actually noted in the second century by people who thought that the whole idea was based on a mistranslation. But it becomes very important for the history of Christianity. However, I don't just, you know, want to debunk this as a historian by any means, because I think that the power of Christianity has to do with its enormous symbolic appeal to a deep sense of truth, which goes far beyond the literal.
Do you think as more and more historical work is done on the Gospel of Thomas, and as it maybe becomes more familiar to Christians, that it might become a more accepted part of the Christian tradition?
Seems to me that the people who read the Gospel of Thomas often intuitively love it, and I would be very surprised if it didn't become more part of the tradition. I really wish that I could have included the whole of the Gospel of Thomas in this book, because it's a marvelous, succinct, short collection of sayings which are enormously powerful.
Would you like to leave us with a few more lines from it?
Yes. The lines that I love right now are the ones in which Jesus says, "I am the light that is before all things. I am all things. All things come forth from me. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up the rock, and you will find me there."
Well, Elaine Pagels, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Elaine Pagels is the author of Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, now out in paperback. She's a professor of religion at Princeton University. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, ancient forms of Christianity that were reformed or suppressed. We'll talk with religion scholar Bart Ehrman. Also, a review of the new film Anchorman. It opens across the country today. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Christianity in its many modern forms is based on the 27 books of the New Testament. But we get conflicting views of Christ's life and teachings from the recently rediscovered ancient Gospels that were excluded from the canon. Bart Ehrman is a scholar of neglected and recently rediscovered ancient Christian writings. He has two recent books. Lost Scriptures is a collection of writings from books that didn't make it into the New Testament. Some of the translations are his own. In the book Lost Christianities, Ehrman explores what these non-canonical writings reveal about the various forms of Christian faith and practice in the second and third centuries. Ehrman chairs the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Terry spoke to him in December.
Many of the non-canonical works that you've collected and written about in your two new books belong to three different schools of thought. Let's talk about what those three different schools are. Let's start with the Ebionites. Who were they?
The Ebionites were Jewish Christians. They were started out as Jews who followed Jewish customs. They were born Jewish, probably, followed Jewish customs such as circumcision, observance of the Sabbath, kosher food laws, and such. But these Jews had come to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. They accepted Jesus as the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God to the Jewish people in fulfillment of the Jewish law. And so they understood that to follow Jesus, a person needs to be Jewish. That meant that the Gentiles, the non-Jews converting to the faith, according to the Ebionites, had to become Jewish. The men had to be circumcised, and men and women had to keep kosher and observe Sabbath and such. And so they were a Jewish group within early Christianity.
So they didn't see Christianity as a break from their Jewish faith, just as a new development within it.
Yeah, they saw Christianity as the fulfillment of the expectations of Judaism. They maintained, since this was Jesus was the Jewish Messiah sent from the Jewish God, that obviously this is still a Jewish religion. And so they retained the Old Testament as their scriptures and had other scriptures that did not eventually make it into the canon, but other gospels, for example, that they said were inspired and authoritative that emphasized the Jewishness of Christianity.
Now, what about the Marcionites?
The Marcionites stand at the other end of the spectrum theologically from the Ebionites. The Marcionites followed a teacher from the second century named Marcion, who was a famous theologian, philosopher, who had as his hero the Apostle Paul. Paul had said that a person is made right with God apart from the Jewish law, and Marcion pushed this to an extreme, saying that there's a difference between the law on the one hand and the gospel on the other hand, that the law is given by God in the Old Testament. It's a harsh law that nobody can follow, and so there's a penalty for not following the law, which is death. This harsh, vengeful God of the Old Testament is contrasted with the God of Jesus, who is understood to be loving and merciful, who's come to save people from their sins rather than to condemn them for their sins. Marcion concluded, therefore, that there are, in fact, two different gods. There's the God of the Old Testament and the God of Jesus and Paul. And so he wasn't a monotheist. He believed in two gods, and he rejected all things Jewish as coming from this other God, the wrathful God of the Old Testament.
Do you think that there's anything from that basic premise that survived into the canon?
Well, the hero of Marcion, of course, is the Apostle Paul, as I said, and Paul's writings form a central component within the New Testament now. Paul has more books attributed to him than any other author of the New Testament. And I think, in fact, that this Marcionite view continues on in some churches unknowingly today, where people continue to talk about there being a difference between the Old Testament God of wrath and the New Testament God of love. That was the original view propounded by Marcion.
One of the groups that some of these writings fall under is the Gnostics. Who are the Gnostics?
Well, the Gnostics are a little bit hard to describe because there are a number of early Christian sects that scholars have lumped together under that term, Gnostic. The term Gnostic comes from a Greek word, gnosis, spelled with a G, G-N-O-S-I-S, gnosis, which means knowledge. These people are called Gnostics because despite the differences among them, they all emphasize that knowledge is the way to salvation. The basic Gnostic system appears to have maintained that this world we live in, this material world, is not the creation of the one true God, but in fact is a cosmic disaster that happened, and that people are trapped spirits. Spirits have been entrapped here in human bodies and need to escape this evil material world. And the way they escape this evil material world is by acquiring the proper knowledge, the gnosis, necessary for salvation. In these Gnostic religions, for many of them, Christ is the one who comes from heaven to reveal this knowledge that can set people free from bondage to their bodies.
Let's talk about some of these early books and what some of their different interpretations are. Let's start with the divinity of Jesus. What do the different sects of Christianity that these books are from say about the divinity of Jesus? Is he the Son of God? Is he divine himself? Is he merely a man?
This is one of the hottest debated points in early Christianity. Today, of course, Christians tend to say that Jesus is both divine and human, both God and man. But in early Christianity, there were wide-ranging debates over who exactly Jesus was. This group called the Ebionites, this group of Jewish Christians, maintained that Jesus was completely human and only human, that he was born to the sexual union of Joseph and Mary, that he was like the rest of us, only he was more righteous. And since he was more righteous than the rest of us, God chose him to be his son and appointed a task to him to be the one who would die for the sins of others. So in that system, Jesus is completely human and not at all divine. Contrast that with the Marcionite Christians, who maintained that Jesus was completely divine. He was he was one who came from the good God to save people from the wrathful God of the Old Testament, and he didn't belong to the God of the Old Testament who created this world. Since he didn't belong to the God who created this world, he couldn't be part of the creation itself, which means, for the Marcionites, he was never born. In fact, the Marcionites maintained that he descended from heaven as a full-grown human in the appearance of human flesh, so that he was, in fact, a phantasm, fully divine and only seeming to be human.
What about the Gnostic texts?
The Gnostics have a particularly interesting understanding of it, because they understand that there's something divine and human about Jesus. And so what they maintain is that Jesus Christ is two things, that Jesus is a man, like other humans, who was born into this world, who was a righteous man. And the Christ is a divine being that comes down from heaven to inhabit the body of Jesus, so that the Christ is different from Jesus. The Christ is a divine being inhabiting Jesus' body during his ministry. That's why he doesn't start doing any miracles until after his baptism for these people, because that's when the divine Christ came into him. And then at the end of his life, since the divine element cannot suffer, since it's divine, Jesus at the end cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Literally, my God, why have you left me behind? It's because the divine element at that point, according to the Gnostics, had left Jesus and returned to its heavenly abode. So for them, Jesus Christ was two things, and there's a separation between the Jesus and the Christ.
How do the early sects of Christianity explain the birth of Jesus? Are there virgin birth stories in the other early sects?
Some of the early sects maintained that that Jesus was born of a virgin, and even in what I would call proto-Orthodox circles, in other words, the circles that held to the views that eventually became Orthodox, even in these proto-Orthodox circles, there are traditions about Jesus' miraculous birth that are somewhat different from the traditions we find in the New Testament. There's a very interesting early text called the Proto-Gospel of James, which is allegedly written by Jesus' own brother, James, in which there's an account of of Mary giving birth, and when she gives birth, Joseph, narrating it in the first person, actually sees time stand still. He sees that sheep aren't moving in the field and birds aren't flying through the air, and humans are frozen in space just as the Son of God is being born. Joseph goes off then to find a midwife in order to assist with the delivery When the midwife arrives, the child's already been miraculously born. The midwife doesn't believe it, however, and decides that she needs to give a physical inspection of Mary, a postpartum physical inspection, to see if, in fact, she really was a virgin. And she gives her a postpartum inspection, and it turns out not to have been a good thing, because then her hand starts burning off in judgment for disbelieving that the virgin has given birth. Jesus, then, the infant Jesus, ends up healing her hand, so it all works out well in the end. This has to do with the idea that Mary continued to be a virgin even after Jesus, as is a doctrine, for example, in the Roman Catholic Church, that Mary was a perpetual virgin.
And what about Jesus's death and resurrection? How do the early sects that you were describing describe his death, and do they believe in his resurrection?
Well, it's a really good question. These different groups had different understandings of the death and the resurrection. There were some groups, of course, who said that Jesus' death is what brings about the salvation of the world. That would be the proto-Orthodox view. There were other people who said that Jesus died, but his death had nothing to do with the salvation of the world. For example, the Gospel of Thomas, these 114 sayings of Jesus that appear to be Gnostic in their orientation, they think that the way to have eternal life is by understanding Jesus' secret teachings. His death has no role to play in salvation. There were some Gnostic groups that maintained that when Jesus died, it was just the man Jesus who died, that the Christ had left him to die alone on the cross so that the divine element didn't suffer at all. There are other Christians who maintain that since Jesus was fully divine and not really human, that he didn't have a flesh and blood body, so that he didn't die at all, that it was just an appearance to deceive the enemies of Jesus, the demons and the devil, but in fact, Jesus himself never actually died.
Bart Ehrman speaking with Terry Gross. He's the author of Lost Scriptures, books that did not make it into the New Testament, and Lost Christianities, The Battles for Scripture and the Faiths We Never Knew. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bart Ehrman, a scholar of early Christianity and the ancient texts that didn't make it into the New Testament. He says the 27 books that did make it into the canon were chosen by the second half of the 4th century.
Were the texts that didn't make it into the canon suppressed?
Yeah, well, once it was decided which books were to be included, there was also a decision that the heretical books had to be destroyed and taken away. That's why we often don't have the original writings of many of these early Christian sects, because they were destroyed on the order of some of the bishops. We do have discussions in early church writings about how to decide which books to include. And the early Christians seem to follow four major criteria for judgment. First, a book had to be ancient if it were going to be included. Secondly, related to the idea of it having to be ancient, a book had to be written by an apostle or a companion of the apostles. Now, some of the books were anonymous, which created problems. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, for example, don't claim to be written by people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the titles they have, but whoever gave them these titles was trying to say that this is the gospel according to Matthew. What happened is Christians in the early second century started saying these anonymous books actually are connected with apostles, and so they attached names of apostles or companions of the apostles to these anonymous books so they could be accepted, because books had to be not only ancient but also apostolic. The third thing is that books had to have widespread usage throughout the world of Christendom in order to be accepted into the canon. And fourth and finally, books had to be orthodox, meaning they had to agree with the correct understanding of the faith to be included, so that a book like the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Thomas ended up being excluded precisely because these books were understood not to represent the orthodox faith.
The group that you describe as proto-Orthodox in early Christianity is the group that's closest to what is in the New Testament. Who was this group?
Well, it's a somewhat amorphous group in that we know of some people who belong, but it's probably a fairly large group with many differences among them. We call them the proto-Orthodox because they represent the points of view that eventually became dominant in early Christianity, that eventually became Orthodox. But these people were living before this victory that they won, and so we call them proto-Orthodox. These are people like Ignatius of Antioch and Clement of Rome and Tertullian and names that many students of early Christianity would be familiar with, although they're not household names any longer. These are people who insisted on certain theological points of view. They insisted that there's only one God. There's not two or 12 or 30. That Jesus is his son who's both human and divine. He's not just human. He's not just divine. He's both. These are people who developed the idea of the Trinity, that God is in three persons. There's only one God, but this God is manifest in three persons. And they're the Christians who decided how the churches would be run. They insisted that there would be bishops over churches, and eventually that there would be bishops over the bishops, and eventually that there would be one bishop over all, the Bishop of Rome, who eventually then becomes the Pope. So these are the people who insisted on points of view that became dominant in Christianity and that determined the shape of Christianity for the ages to come down to our own day.
How did you become interested in the early non-canonical texts?
Well, when I was in graduate school, two things were happening that sparked my interest. One was I became increasingly interested in the diversity of the New Testament itself. I had started out as an evangelical Christian, thinking that the text of Scripture was completely inspired and without any error. But as I started working on these texts, reading them in the original Greek language, studying them intensely, I started finding wide-ranging differences among these books. And soon I started seeing contradictions in the text, and I started seeing that these different authors had different perspectives, including perspectives that were at odds with each other within the pages of the New Testament. At the same time I was finding that, I became interested in other books not found in the New Testament. I started studying the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, books that are called the Apostolic Fathers, such as the Shepherd of Hermas or the Epistle of Barnabas. And I began to realize that that Christianity outside the canon was even more diverse than Christianity within the canon. And so these two elements of my study are what really sparked the interest that culminated in these two books that I've written.
In your own studies, when you realized that there was such diversity of reporting among the different early texts about Christ, was that did that become a crisis of faith for you?
Yeah, for me personally, it did lead to a crisis of faith because unlike a lot of my friends who were studying the same material, my friends didn't have the kind of evangelical belief in the inerrancy of the Bible that I had. Their faith was rooted in something else other than a particular doctrine about the Bible. But since my faith had been rooted in evangelical teachings about the Bible, once I started realizing that there were discrepancies in the Bible that I simply couldn't resolve without having to do a lot of very fancy footwork, I decided that the Bible wasn't the inerrant rule of faith and practice that I had assumed. And for me, this led to a real crisis, an emotional crisis of faith. But it's interesting that my friends at the time, I happened to be at seminary, Princeton Theological Seminary. My friends at the time learned everything I learned and would agree with most of the things that I think and continue to be solid believers, but it's because their faith wasn't built on some understanding of the inerrancy of the Bible.
Can you speak at all about how you resolve that crisis of faith or how your understanding of Jesus Christ has changed?
Well, I think what I've come to is a realization that that Christianity, above all, is a historical religion that makes historical claims about a historical person, about Jesus of Nazareth. And so it seems to me that whatever a person happens to believe theologically, that Christians are obligated to consider their religion historically, and that historical knowledge can threaten faith, and it may threaten to change a person's faith, but it's not a bad thing, because this is a historical religion, and historical knowledge can deepen the understanding of this religion precisely because it's such a historical faith.
Well, Bart Ehrman, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Bart Ehrman speaking with Terry Gross last December. He has two recent books, Lost Christianities and Lost Scriptures. Ehrman chairs the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Coming up, we turn to the movies. This is Fresh Air. Will Ferrell stars in the new comedy Anchorman, about a local TV news show set in the 70s. Ferrell co-wrote the script with director and former Saturday Night Live head writer Adam McKay. Christina Applegate co-stars as a rival reporter eyeing an anchor spot. David Edelstein has this review.
Watching Anchorman, I flash back to a time when I was a kid. I was in a restaurant, and who sits down at the next table but the local station's Anchorman and Anchorwoman. Today we'd call them anchor persons, but this was the 70s. It must have been between the 6 and 11 o'clock news, so they had traces of caramel pancake makeup. But it was the guy's hair I couldn't take my eyes off. It was so dark and wavy and confident, like his voice, which had such resonance you could hear it all over the restaurant, whether you wanted to or not. No mere mortal was in our midst. Even if all he did was read other people's words off a teleprompter, the TV camera invested this boob with the kind of authority that made him seem more real than any of us. Anchorman comes on as a satire of that era. Before, a prologue tells us there was cable, and you were stuck with three local stations and PBS. Will Ferrell, who co-wrote the movie with the director, Adam McKay, plays Ron Burgundy, one of those helmet hair guys, and a swaggering San Diego demigod. The film shows everyone from infants to mean hairy bikers watching him in awe. So do we, although for different reasons. He has thick eyebrows and a dark caterpillar mustache that doesn't quite make it up to the bottom of his nose, giving it a glued-on look. And when he struts around shirtless, fancying himself quite the babe magnet, the lack of visible musculature is breathtaking. His attempt at seducing Christina Applegate as the station's new hire, Veronica Cornerstone, is the first of the movie's many gross-outs.
1,001. 1,002.
Mr. Burgundy.
1,003.
Helen said that you needed to see me.
Oh, Miss Corningstone. I wasn't expecting company. Just doing my workout. Tuesday's arms and back.
Well, you asked me to come by, sir.
Oh, did I?
Yes.
Oh, it's a deep burn. Oh, it's so deep. Oh, I could barely lift my right arm because I did so many. I don't know if you heard me counting. I did over 1,000. You have your ubulus muscle that connects to the upper dorsimus. It's boring, but it's part of my life. I'm just going to grab this shirt if you don't mind. Just watch out for the guns. They'll get you.
You are pathetic. This has to be the feeblest pickup attempt that I have ever encountered. You know, I expected it from the rest of them, Mr. Burgundy, but not from you.
Anchorman is about Ron's seduction of Veronica and about their ferocious rivalry when she, a female, ends up as his co-anchor, and about the way that this becomes empowering to all the subservient women at the station. No, scratch that. It's not about any of those tired old romantic feminist cliches. What it's really about is pushing the comedy envelope. Here's how that works. They take a narrative structure that is extremely conventional. Beat by beat, it could be that awful Robert Redford, Michelle Pfeiffer picture, up close and personal. Now Ferrell and McKay take those scenes and don't just add jokes. They add jokes so broad the scenes go past dumb, past unreal, and into some stratosphere of camp that throws you totally out of the movie. Men discussing love break unself-consciously into a dainty pop tune, then snap back into brusque male conversation. Burgundy and his sports guy and weatherman and investigative reporter cross paths with rival anchor teams like street gangs. They trade insults about toilets and their mothers. And in one spectacular sequence, packed with star cameos, they go at it with guns and knives and medieval instruments. You're not laughing at Anchorman. You're laughing at formula movie rituals blown sky high. Ferrell isn't one of those natural clowns who have rubbery features or a plastic body. His timing isn't the sharpest. He's not a virtuoso. But he gets huge laughs because he's not afraid to take a joke to the next level, the way the Marx Brothers always did. Anchorman has a free associational quality and something else, an atmosphere of fooling around and taking chances. And this grab bag approach has amazing cumulative power so that the clunkers don't matter. You're finally just relaxed and happy, enjoying the gifted ensemble and waiting to get smacked with the next outlandish gag. This is an ugly looking movie, and the lighting does no favors for Christina Applegate. Its preoccupations are smutty and infantile. Its targets obvious. Yet it strides above its crudeness like a colossus. It's smart people telling dumb jokes with a brilliant sense of irony. Anchorman gives you permission to laugh like an idiot.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the band One Ring Zero. Their new CD features lyrics written by authors like this one from Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, also actor Clive Owen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If I had a radio for every time you loved me so, I wouldn't have a radio at all. Now I sit and waste my time.